This is The Takeaway. I'm Arun Roth, filling in for Tanzina Vega this week. Thanks so much for being with us. Today, we're going to spend some time on a painful topic, sexual abuse within religious institutions. Last week, Pope Francis acknowledged for the first time that nuns have been victims of sexual crimes by religious leaders in the Catholic Church. Later this hour, we'll hear one nun's account of the abuse she faced.
I don't remember conversation before or after. I only remember that she took my face in her two hands and kissed me all over my face. And then I just remember leaving. I felt the same way I felt as a child. I felt lost. I felt abandoned. I felt confused. I felt alone.
That story of abuse within the Catholic Church coming up later. But for now, we turn to another denomination, one that was founded right here in the U.S., the Southern Baptist Convention. Just this weekend, a new investigation revealed decades of sexual abuse by church leaders and volunteers. Compiled after 6 months of reporting by the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, the investigation found that since 1988, some 380 church leaders and volunteers have faced allegations of sexual misconduct. To date, 220 have been convicted. Some took plea deals, others confessed or resigned, but others are still involved in churches where they may have access to potential victims. The perpetrators of these crimes came from all levels of power within the church, from youth pastors and ministers to Sunday school teachers and deacons. There are more than 700 victims. Joining me now are two of the journalists who helped report this investigation. Robert Downen is a reporter with the Houston Chronicle, and Lisa Olson is deputy investigations editor at the Houston Chronicle. Robert and Lisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Arun.
Robert, can you start by giving us a sense of scale here? How big is a Southern Baptist church? How many churches are there, and how is it structured?
So I think that's a really important thing and dynamic to this story is that, unlike the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptist Convention is very decentralized. While we do reference, you know, SBC leaders within our story, there is no pope or someone who can, you know, make decrees and force other churches to do really anything. A bedrock of the Baptist polity is local church autonomy, which means that the 47,000 churches that cooperate as part of the Southern Baptist Convention really are self-governing and independent, which is one of the reasons that implementing reforms to stop the kind of sexual abuses that we found has been a difficult thing, speaking among the broader Southern Baptist Convention.
And it's a wide range of churches across the country, you know, the mega churches to small town churches.
Sure, sure. And I think also there's a tendency to think, because of the name Southern Baptist Convention, that all of these churches are located in the South. That is incorrect. We found, you know, cases in New York, cases in Oregon. While the name implies that they are based in the South, they are very much a nationwide and really worldwide organization.
Now, your investigation found a pattern of sexual assault and abuse. How far does this go, both in time and geography?
So we wanted to focus on the 20-year period since 1998, because 2008 was the year that Southern Baptist Convention leadership, the executive committee, rejected a lot of reforms that activists and victims had said would have helped prevent sexual abuse. And so what we found, as you mentioned at the start of the show, 380 church leaders and volunteers who faced sexual misconduct allegations, and that includes, you know, those who were convicted, charged, credibly accused, and successfully sued or confessed or resigned. But as you said, you know, it's not confined to any one type of church. We found these cases range, you know, from mega churches in Houston to tiny, tiny little congregations located in rural areas.
Some of the stories that are included in this investigation are very troubling to hear and read about. Could you tell us about Anne Marie Miller's story and how it fits in with the larger patterns you found in this investigation?
So Anne Miller was, she was a teenager when a youth pastor that she knew started a relationship with her, allegedly, that turned sexual. That man, the case against him is pending right now. But Miller, after learning that he had gone on to work at the Southern Baptist Convention's mission board and was a somewhat high-ranking official there, she met with the mission board in 2007, and they had an internal investigation that mission board officials said at the time supported her story. And after that investigation concluded, her alleged attacker was able to leave, go work at churches in Arkansas before finding work at the South Carolina Baptist State Convention. And I think her story was kind of a watermark when it kind of broke in July for a lot of Southern Baptists. You know, they've been grappling with a few high-profile scandals involving sexual abuse and the handling of sexual abuse in the months before that. The response from mission board officials that came to light when Miller came forward, I think definitely was kind of a wake-up call to a lot of people about how these things have been handled internally often and some of the language that's deployed when talking to victims. I think this, the quote that stands out is from a mission board official who, just after the investigation had concluded, they were trying to ask her to forgive the attacker and, you know, move on with her life.
We read these reports of some of these women having abortions as a result of the sexual abuse. Were the perpetrators of these crimes, Lisa, were they pressuring these women to terminate their pregnancies?
There are a couple of cases where the perpetrators pressured the young women, often they were teenagers, to terminate pregnancies to hide what happened. There's also a case of Debbie Vasquez, who had the child of the person who molested her, and he required her or asked her to stand up before the congregation and apologize for her sins, knowing all the while that he was the one who had done this to her. That's one of the people who came forward early on and asked the leadership in the SBC to make changes was Debbie Vasquez. And so we focused on her, even though that is entirely true that there's this concept of local autonomy. These churches also elect leadership. They elect an executive committee every year, and often these are pastors who serve 2 years in the positions of president, vice president, and they really do set some general guidelines and policies for and the direction for the entire church. So one of the things we did look at was how some of them had handled individual decisions at their own churches, as well as failing to act on some of the reforms victims like Debbie Vasquez wanted.
We hear some of these really disturbing stories from the survivors of the abuse, but you also sat down and interviewed some of the predators who are now behind bars. What did they have to say for what they had done?
I did the interviews with our videographer, John Shapley, and he and I wrote to 20 different people who were in Texas prisons because we had in Texas more perpetrators like this than in any other state, in part because the SBC is such an important church in Texas. And three of them agreed to sit down and talk to us. There were others who wrote to us. The three of them had really different attitudes. One of them was from a very small church in a very small town and was very, I would say, repentant for what he had done. He considered what he had done to be sort of a mental illness. And he really spoke very eloquently about how he felt the Baptist church in particular was not honest enough about problems within the church, whether it be pastors or parishioners who deal with sex addiction or pornography addiction or other kinds of problems. And that the fact that the churches do not discuss it allows it to go undetected. There was another pastor I interviewed, a youth pastor, who I think was very much expressing repentance for what he had done. However, at the same time, he was conflicted, I think, about it. He, though, said clearly, youth pastors in particular have opportunities to get too close to teenagers, and there's a slippery slope between being a counselor and a pastor. The third person, a guy named Steve Livingston, who was a deacon at a church in Corpus Christi, expressed really no remorse at all. In fact, he considered himself a victim. He abused several little girls who were in a church program, and he was driving them to movies, and they were sitting on his lap, kind of considering him sort of a grandfatherly figure, and he abused them.
Is the Southern Baptist Convention doing anything now to prevent abuse from happening in the church? Have they taken any steps to reform the church to protect people?
There's definitely movement towards that. Leadership has definitely, in their comments publicly, you know, said that this report, they welcomed it and the information in it. But again, one of the main things that's been suggested by activists and victims and some people within the SBC itself is this database of people who have been convicted or credibly accused or confessed to sexual crimes so that these churches can know before they hire someone what they're getting into or what this person's history might be. And so we went ahead and did some of that work for them. And if you go to HoustonChronicle.com, you can find a database of about 220 people who were convicted or took plea deals in the last 20 years.
We've talked about the material you cover in part one of this story, which is out now. There are two still parts to come. Can you give us a sketch, a little preview of what the next parts will focus on?
Part two, which we'll publish tomorrow, is about the pastors and others who successfully moved from one church to another, finding new victims along the way. Cases we've documented across the country. There are 35 of them that we share in that story and in a map. And part three is about, in particular, youth pastors who prey on teenagers, primarily both men and women, and the particular types of mechanisms they've used to abuse teens, which include a lot of use of social media and texting. Very disturbing stories.
I'm wondering if you have a sense of how comprehensive this is. Do you feel like you've got to it all, or is there still more in terms of abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention that needs to be reported?
We had a three-person team, and I was one of the people who took a list that Rob created from searching news articles nationwide of people who might have been convicted and then tried to track down whether they had been convicted all across the country. If our basically three people in a matter of a few months could assemble proof that 220 people had been convicted, if the churches actually collaborated and provided all that information, the search tool would be infinitely larger. We're hearing from crowdsourcing now lots and lots of stories from people about cases we missed. And many of these cases happen in small counties. The records aren't online. They don't have newspapers that have archives online. So there's no way for us to find out about all of these. And then there's a lot of people who were never prosecuted, but who probably should have been. So I know we've just gotten a small part of what's a big, much bigger problem.
That's Lisa Olson, the Deputy Investigations Editor at the Houston Chronicle. Robert Downen is a reporter at the Houston Chronicle. The first of their three-part series was published over the weekend. You can read the investigation on HoustonChronicle.com and on MySanAntonio.com. The other two parts of their investigation will be released later this week. Lisa and Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
This is Arun Roth filling in for Tanzina here on The Takeaway.